As a manager, you need to know how you can make your organization more efficient. Listen for Management Friday on Federal News Radio. We bring you information on the keystone of success for any agency or business. Friday mornings at 10, listen for AFGE's perspective on inside government. Next at 11, Shaw, Bransford, and Roth talk about the legal implications of management decisions on Fed Talk. And at noon, listen for Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch to hear what career options may be available. Management Friday, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Headed to Fort Detrick or the I-270 Technology Corridor, Federal News Radio can be heard crystal clear on 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. It's the same great station, just on an added frequency. Get the latest news about the federal government and government contractors. Hear exclusive interviews with the movers and shakers in the federal arena. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM or 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. Federal News Radio, your source for federal news now.
Good morning. Welcome to the September 25th, 2012 panel event, The Accidental Insider Threat. Is your organization ready? This event is part of the Expert Voices Distinguished Speakers series and is supported by the firm's cyber campaign. It is my pleasure to introduce Rainer Dahlquist, Vice President at Booz Allen Hamilton. Rainer?
Thank you, Yolanda. Welcome to the Federal News Radio Expert Voices panel. The panel today is The Accidental Insider Threat. Is your organization ready? I'm Rainer Dahlquist, the Vice President for Booz Allen Hamilton Cyber Solutions Network. Today, I anticipate an informative discussion about what we call accidental insider threats. These are threats that are not maliciously intended to be a detriment to a company or a firm, but nonetheless, they do the same type of damage. What I'd like to do is introduce you first to our very distinguished panelists, and I anticipate from each of their backgrounds that we will have a lively discussion today. To my left, Tom Kellerman is the Vice President of Cybersecurity at Trend Micro. In this role, he is responsible for the analysis of emerging cybersecurity threats and relevant defensive technologies, strategic partnerships, and government affairs. Tom served as a commissioner of the Commission on Cybersecurity for the 44th Presidency and sits on the boards of the National Cybersecurity Alliance, the International Cybersecurity Protection Alliance, and the National Board of Information Security Examiners Panel for Penetration Testing. To his left, Angela McKay is a principal security strategist on the Global Security Strategy and Diplomacy team at Microsoft. In this role, she focuses on driving strategic change both within Microsoft and externally to advance cybersecurity and resiliency. Currently, she focuses on helping to shape U.S. cybersecurity policy and facilitating international collaboration to improve cybersecurity globally. She also serves as the vice chair of the Information Technology Sector Coordinating Council and is Microsoft's point of contact for the National Security Telecommunications Advisory Committee. To her left, Michael Theis is the chief counterintelligence expert at the CERT Insider Threat Center. In this role, he uses his 25 plus years as a counterintelligence supervisory special agent supporting the U.S. intelligence community, along with his 30 plus years of concurrent computer systems engineering experience, to aid CERT in furthering its research and development of socio-technical controls in insider threats. Previously, Michael was the first ever cyber counterintelligence program manager for the National Reconnaissance Office, where he served as the chief for cyber CI investigations and operations for more than 6 years. Welcome to all of our panelists. Our first topic of the day is to set the stage and define what really is an accidental insider threat. So first and foremost, I guess, Michael, I'd like to tee up to you for a definition. If you can help us just to talk a little bit about what is the accidental insider and what makes them different from the malicious insider, what kind of research do we have on these types of threats?
Okay, well, thank you for throwing out the very first question to me, so I had no time to, you know, ease into this. But to sort of talk about this definition, what I'd like to do is actually take it from the other direction, which is to say, what is a malicious insider? We define that as an employee or a contractor or someone who has authorized access to an organization's systems and networks and uses that access to create harm or damage or something that's inappropriate against organizational policies. So the unintentional would be the lack of the intent, the lack of the purposefully malicious insider. And that's really an area that CERT would like to study a little bit more. But unfortunately, there's a lot of people right now who believe that they understand exactly what an unintentional insider is and how it's defined. So we have a lot of empirical research on the malicious insider, and we'd really love to expand that to the unintentional.
Great, thank you. Angela, from research, it appears that we have some main access points which accidental insiders typically become of harm to their company. And these range everywhere from, you know, socially engineered issues all the way over to just lax IT policies within firms. Can you give us a little bit of your point of view in terms of how you would define the access points for these insider threats?
Certainly. I think that most people do tend to think about the social engineering side first, but there are definitely other vectors by which this can occur. First, I'd like to note that based on Microsoft Security Intelligence Report version 11, we found that malicious incidents, not on the insider side, but overall, malicious incidents counted for less than half of the total incidents that occur. And while you'll think most often of the social engineering side, we found that lost, stolen, and missing equipment is oftentimes the most frequent access point. In addition, you do see accidental disclosure, oftentimes via the web, and improper disposal of records also being something that is quite frequent.
Thanks, Angela. I know that you alluded to research CERT has on malicious insider threats. Do you have an expanded view of some of the things Angela's just been talking about, Michael?
Well, yeah, I can always say that from my personal experience. Again, having worked in this field for more than 25 years, insider threat is actually not new. It's, you know, it's been around for a long time. We used to call it just counterintelligence, but now we have a nice, good label, and everyone gets to play together, which is actually important because for the insider, it takes an entire organization. It's not just a one specific job description that sort of thwarts insiders. And some of the reasons for that are because there are other vectors that people, or ways that people do things, just like what Angela was mentioning. So for instance, someone might inadvertently attach a privately owned device to your computer network. Maybe they're trying to power an iPod. Maybe they're, you know, powering up an iPad or whatever it is. But they could inadvertently provide a backdoor access point without realizing it, having Bluetooth enabled, any number of things, malicious code which may be on there, exposing their personal information to the network, which maybe the organization didn't want their personal information on the network, those kinds of things. And then the inadvertent disclosures, as she mentioned, we see this a lot maybe in social media, and especially with family members. I find that is where sometimes people don't realize just how much family members can reveal about maybe some of the sensitive aspects of your job or the things that are, you know, confidential to your company. In my own personal experience, you know, I've had my own grandchildren talking on Facebook and stuff like that and realize that they just inadvertently disclosed where they live. You know, that's a very concerning type thing. So you can imagine how that happens in the work environment also.
Thank you. Tom, your work focuses on the analysis of emerging cybersecurity threats. From a cyber IT perspective, how prevalent are these threats from accidental insiders? And can you talk to us a little bit about what's more difficult to detect from a control perspective?
So what we've seen in the past year is a tremendous explosion in targeted attacks, as well as a privatization of the APT phenomenon that we think used to only be the monopoly of regimes. We're also seeing an explosion of not just mobile threats, but web injection and drive-by download attacks that can utilize trusted resources and convert, I guess, users into the accidental insiders because of their dependency upon these computing resources. I do think that mobile devices is a new point of inflection in the marketplace for attack code. And there actually is an arms bazaar that exists now where people can actually acquire capability that they didn't have before. So to your final point, I think what's different now is that the paradigm has to shift away from trying to build perpetual castles in cyberspace. How do we actually increase the level of discomfort of an adversary, whether it's actually a malicious insider, an accidental insider, so that they can't maintain a presence, they would have to use far too many resources to do so.
Can you give us a little bit of an example of one of the black hole kits so that people can kind of understand how well-meaning employees inside of a firm may actually be targeted and taken advantage of?
So there's a capability that any one of you can buy right now and download called the Black Hole Exploit Kit that's constantly updated every day, literally with zero-day exploits and newfangled capabilities. But what it does is it allows you to actually perform not only reconnaissance on folks to ascertain what emails you would trust from what businesses, but also what websites you would trust. And in doing so, when you visit those sites, because the email looks like an email you would receive from said source, you're redirected immediately to a compromised web server that will push attack code into your system down your browser's throat. Attack code that's manipulating the 0 days that exist in the wild that have been pushed up inside of this thing, allowing them to have a footprint on your system and allowing your system to now become that digital insider, that accidental insider. What's interesting is that commoditization and automation, and we call the Black Hole Exploit Kit blast phishing, because in fact it's more than spear phishing, because you're essentially stunning the fish and hitting a large number of them and forcing them to rise up to the top of the water because they implicitly entrust that environment.
Thank you. Now that we've characterized the threat, accidental insider, and we've talked about the fact that seemingly leaving your passwords out in the wild, not shutting down an account after an employee leaves the firm, saying I'm sitting in my hotel room in Phoenix and I'm online, I think I'll go for a jog and leave this thing running. You know, there's a lot of different ways that we actually can see employees becoming accidental insiders. Let's talk a little bit about assessing and measuring the impact of accidental insiders, because I think, Michael, to your point, there's not a lot of data out there about malicious versus accidental, but the threat to the IT professional who's trying to control this issue inside of the firm is still the same, trying to assess what controls need to be in place and then how effective they're going to be. When we look at how to assess and measure, from your experience at CERT, Michael, or your prior experience, what do you think is the most important thing to assess and measure from an IT professional's perspective?
Well, let's see. The most important, I am one of those people who tries not to like put things in an order like that. What I would say is some of the most important things that, you know, we have to consider is obviously, you know, what is the cost of recovery? What is the cost of what's lost? If it's intellectual property, if it's, you know, trade secrets, if it's personal information, you know, there are a lot of laws out there now that hold you liable, you know, for the loss of somebody's social security number, any number of things. The loss of reputation to the organization is obviously a big factor. And when we're trying to measure, you know, as we sort of anecdotally try to measure, you know, the difference between an insider who's malicious and an insider is accidental, I think that a lot of people would believe that an accidental insider doesn't cause nearly as much damage as someone who's purposely trying to accomplish something. But I'm not so sure that that's actually true, which is why I believe it has to be studied scientifically so that we have empirical evidence to know whether or not that's true. I read an article this morning talked about that the Secret Service had done a survey saying that an insider threat costs an average of about $7 million per incident for an organization. I believe that was taking in all those factors, but I have not read that report myself yet. But I thought it was pretty interesting that, you know, we are seeing that an insider attack is expensive. Now, whether or not we can break that down between accidental and purposeful malicious, that's something we still have to look at.
Thanks. For any of the panelists, typically speaking, from the point of view of the security professional inside the firm, or from for any of the C-suite level folks dealing with this issue, how long, typically speaking, does either a malicious or an accidental insider threat potentially go unnoticed? You know, what are kind of the, you know, how long does it take? Because one would imagine that because this is a trusted employee to the firm, there are lots of things that this employee could be doing that don't necessarily tip the radar, so to speak. So when you look at the short-term and long-term impact of assessing this, you know, what are we typically talking about in assessing and knowing that you've got a situation at hand?
I think there's two issues there, one of which is organizations are miserable about conducting appropriate logging and file integrity monitoring of what's going on within their ecosystems. Elite hackers that target elite organizations like to maintain clandestine presence within systems to move laterally within those systems. I think the best study was OMB's study where they evaluated all the breaches that had occurred in the U.S. government and noted that most of them had maintained a persistent presence for over 9 months' time. I think an issue there is the problem is that most organizations have been focused on resiliency and business continuity in the post 9/11 world. And in doing that, most of the resiliency and business continuity movement of the post 9/11 world has exacerbated your cybersecurity posture because you've got more remote access, you've got backup data centers, you've got applications to access everything. And so to your point, I think it's very important that the culture change within organizations. For one, the chief security officers and CISOs do not necessarily get along and don't communicate the same messaging. So chief security officer is focused on deploying technology to stop kinetic events. And the chief information security officer, who's not even at the same level of a CSO, who's still reporting to a CIO, is still trying to argue for the fact that these technologies need to be sustainable through security. And that needs to change. I think CISOs need to be empowered so we can get greater visibility on this issue alone.
And maybe I'll just add to that point. I would agree with Tom that while we've been talking about defense in depth for a long period of time, what you see in most infrastructures is the harder perimeter and a soft underbelly, if you will. And so one of the things that we've talked a lot about is increasing the network segmentation and building out those sensors along the lines between segments of the networks so that you can watch and see when there's an attempt at lateral movement. In some of the studies we've looked at, there have actually been post-breach, kind of a 2 to 3 week period of time, individual incidents, during which there is a lateral movement before the attacker finds the particular information they're looking for. In some cases, there is the 9 month sit, and in some cases, it's the quick out. But you really do see that moving between the network to identify targets. And by building in some segmentation and censoring along the way, you can help mitigate that risk.
And if I could add to that, if we break that down into the categories of what is trying to be accomplished, I think you will see how the timeline shifts a little bit. For instance, for an IT sabotage type of situation, you usually have someone who has a super user type privileges like a system administrator. And the reason that an IT sabotage traditionally would happen is because of an unmet type expectation or disgruntlement and that the person is trying to get back at the organization. So that could occur very early in a person's career. It could occur at the very end near retirement and they felt like they were being cheated. So when that happens in their employment spectrum is hard to really determine. What the observable act, though, is the disgruntlement or the unmet expectations, that should be the tip-off. And usually HR might know that, but not necessarily the IT department knows that you have a person who's in that category. The second one that I'll talk about is fraud. And what you tend to find is that fraud is accomplished after a person has been there for a while and understands how the systems work and then finds ways to exploit the IT systems in order to help with the fraud. And then IP theft tends to happen just before people depart an organization. So how long they were there is not necessarily the factor, but what we have seen is within about 30 days of someone leaving an organization is when they will actually take the intellectual property and start downloading it and exfiltrating it so that they can either take it to their next job or use it in some other type of business endeavor. So that's why it's kind of hard to say, like, how long does it go on before it's detected? It just depends on what kind of category we're talking about of that threat.
Thanks. And of course, some of those are malicious and intent instead of the accidental, but your point is well made that it really depends on and what type of issue we're talking about. I imagine, too, the lax employee who never changes the password becomes an even bigger target versus the employee who's more diligent and those sorts of things. One of the following questions I had is just the life cycle of an attack in terms of the amount of time perhaps from the black hole targeting, if you take that as an example, or kind of picking and choosing the accidental insiders inside of a firm. To your point, Michael, and to your point, Tom, any amount of time? Do these employees get watched for some period of time? Does this happen, you know, immediately? What are we looking at in terms of being targeted?
Well, I'm biased because I'm paying attention. My situational awareness and perspective is focused on elite hacker crews. So they create accidental insiders. They create digital insiders within ecosystems. So Eastern European hacker crews are master craftsmen, and they've done tremendous amount of reconnaissance on you. And when they come for you, they're coming through you like a commando unit would come through those doors. You know exactly what they want. It's two shots, you're dead, and they're out. East Asian hacker crews are much more like thousand grains of sand approach. They're not necessarily sure what that ecosystem looks like. They kind of know what they're looking for. And you've seen a shift in the cyber kill chain itself, where there's actually a maintenance stage being added at an eighth stage to the cyber kill chain. What do I mean by that? These folks, the elites in general now, are actually patching the holes they come through, cleaning the hosts that they've compromised, and then moving their command and control internally and putting on a sleep cycle. Because most of you have been told by the intelligence agencies and by the Bureau that, look, at a minimum, even if the box, you don't see anything on it, check it to see if there's an IP address communication that exists that doesn't exist in DNS cache, right? Because hackers like to use IPs that don't associate with domains. Even now, they're aware of that. They are so cognizant of how we respond that they've actually shifted and maintained that infrastructure internally. We have to pay a certain modicum of respect, but I'll close on this, is that it's not just about nation states anymore, organized crime. You have this phenomenon now where competitive intelligence has shifted, and we can either acquire capability or there will be mercenaries that can be hired to leverage attacks for the purposes of competitive intelligence.
And I'll maybe just add on to that, recognizing that we're in the DC area, there's a great deal of discussion about the advanced persistent threat, and I think, Tom, you have unique insights into that space. But the listenership of the radio and Booz Allen here should also consider that advanced persistent threats are not actually always advanced. And that is one of the great challenges. In fact, in the most incidents that we have been seeing, they are often exploiting either misconfigurations or unpatched systems. And so while you do have the elite hacker groups, there's a lot that organizations can do to mitigate the risk of the insider threat by just maintaining proper hygiene of their systems.
And then I'll add another comment, which has to do with how long somebody is at an organization. There might be another aspect which many folks have not necessarily considered, and many organizations don't really address this from what I've seen. And that is, let's say an individual begins and they have a certain set of privileges and permissions. Then they get promoted to the next level and they get some additional permissions and privileges. But the original ones aren't actually taken away. So all of those things that we put in place for like separation of roles and separation of responsibilities, over a period of 10, 15, 20 years, you can have an individual who doesn't even remember that they have all of these other permissions and stuff, and now their ability to be exploited could be pretty tragic. I mean, if you're looking for someone that you want to be able to exploit in a way as an unintentional insider, I think somebody who's been there for a long time and has amassed many, many permissions is probably a good subject.
Actually, that's a great point, because we keep disrespecting system administrators and we treat them as gnomes. And these people have super user credentials, and they're being targeted because they have super user credentials. Rarely do they even use two-factor authentication, even though they're probably deploying it for most of the executives. And most of the time when an executive says, I need system administrator access to my laptop because I'm a VP at Booz Allen, you give it to them as a sysadmin because that's a VP from within your organization. So we need to respect the fact that we need to empower sysadmins. And to your point, I think it's very important that these sysadmins become educated in proper cybersecurity so they can become assistants for the security team in reconfiguring and managing the security of the enterprise versus just going through that change control process of vulnerability management.
I think we've crossed over into our third topic, which is mitigation, which is great. And we've talked about the security policies and technical controls. We've talked a little bit, just a teeny bit, about user education. So, Angela, let me ask you first, looking at that mix, are there key components to the right mitigation mix? You talked about, you know, general hygiene of the system. We've mentioned a little bit about education of a certain group inside. If you were sort of educating a company very broadly, what would you say is the right recipe for trying to prevent some of these accidental threats?
Well, Well, I'm going to say it's not just about prevention, actually. So I'm going to say it's about prevention, it's about detection, it's about containment, and then it's about response. And there's a series of actions that companies can take, both proactively and reactively post-incident, to mitigate the consequences associated with that. First is, you know, good corporate policy. And corporate policy that is followed. And one of the things that I think is oftentimes challenging is what is the right balance of automating and not automating. So to the degree possible, when we talk about these roles of these different individuals trying to manage security, is to think about how you either incorporate it into their regular business practice or automate so that it is not an additional task on top of their work. Second of all, and we've talked about this a lot, is continuing the training and education. I think that you do see demographic differences in users' comfort with computers, their willingness to share information that they don't necessarily see as private. The younger generation oftentimes is sharing things that maybe the older generation would see as private. But continuing to focus on training and education, it must be in front of people on a regular basis. And then finally, on the reactive side, with detection and response, you also need to have the appropriate information disclosure. What happened? Why did it happen? And how can we roll that back into our strategic risk management practices so that it is either doesn't happen again or is much less likely to?
So I agree with everything that Angela has said, and that I've seen there are two schools of thought in some organizations. One is that education is what's going to save us, is we educate users and they won't do bad things unintentionally. And then I've seen another group that says, no matter what you do, you can't get users to stop doing stupid stuff, so we have to have all these tools and stuff. Now, I have seen one of my hobbies has been to try to figure out how to model human behavior in cyberspace, because I believe that if we can determine what is normal in cyberspace, then we can detect deviations from normal. So rather than trying to look at signatures and always determine what we've already detected as bad and look for that again, I say as long as you know what's normal, you can start to detect the deviation from normal, take a closer look at it, and potentially find out what it might be. So a good example might be antivirus. When antivirus first started, yes, I'm actually that old, before there was antivirus. So when antivirus first started, we actually saw people clicking on more attachments and more things and actually getting infections because the antivirus didn't have a signature for it. And when you would ask them why, they would say, well, we're running antivirus, aren't we? I mean, I thought that was supposed to help this from happening. So I agree, it has to be a balance in there, but everyone has to know that they are responsible for their own security and they're also responsible for the security of their work environment. They can't completely depend on the automation to do that for them.
I will agree with you. As one of the world's largest antivirus developers, I'll say blacklisting is dead. I'll say that you needed to get rid of 95% of the noise, but realistically, whitelisting is definitely the way to go. But I also would state that we have to, again, have greater internal situational awareness. This begins with real behavioral analysis, like you suggested, on the network traffic that occurs within an organization, but also corresponds to this new virtual environment of the cloud. Understanding the integrity of files before the hacker puts a footprint on them, before the insider manipulates the integrity of a file. Having advanced logging. To the vulnerability management piece, we have to solve that problem, but in that we have to move away from that, because at the same time, the problem with our perspective is that vulnerability management is much like your house got robbed and then you're changing the locks every day. We have to get to a threat management perspective, which has to focus on behaviors and channels that can be utilized to compromise our infrastructure. And to achieve that, I really think it's all about, can you replicate your environment in a custom fashion to ascertain what things are happening and whether those things are malicious in their actions, whether it's a sophisticated insider or not. You have to understand whether or not if someone walks through that door right now and sits in the back of the room, they have the capacity to hurt anyone in this room. And you have to just change that paradigm.
Thanks, Tom. I want to shift a little bit to policies. I think, Angela, you brought those up. Just speaking very broadly, because I know policy is a very broad term for most firms to look at, But what would your advice be in terms of mitigating risk and dealing with corporate policies? And I know that those span from IT and security policies all the way over to HR policies, which you were mentioning earlier, Angela. So just broadly speaking, you know, what are the right kinds of policy controls, and where do we see some tension in the system there around policies? And I one thought that comes to mind is this bring your own device to work. You know, how do we kind of allow for some advances in the system from a technology standpoint and still have the right controls in place?
Well, I think this is one where you have to look at the interplay of people, process, and technology across the policy. So you're going to have policy that applies to each one of those. So you're going to have HR policies that deal with access control. What should people be touching? You're going to have process technologies. Where can they go? What can they get into? And then you're going to have technology policies. And there's a lot to do across all those. I do want to hit on a space that was brought up by Michael, which is really kind of starting to think a little bit about the psychology here. And that's one of the things that we've really focused on the people side, not just inside of Microsoft corporate policy, but also in the user experience for end users. We've started to focus on something called the trusted user experience. So I'm going to give a quick example here. Anybody ever been in a browser and had a little window pop up and it said, this site you're trying to browse to may be dangerous? Yeah, probably everyone. Well, what am I supposed to do with that information? It may be dangerous or it may not be dangerous. Which way am I supposed to, you know what to do next? So usually probably most people just click yes, because they want to get to whatever the other side is. So one of the things we're really focused on is advancing the understandability of these kind of notices. And we have a paradigm called NEAT, so that any message must be A, necessary, B, explainable, C, actionable, and finally, D, testable. And so you'll see that, probably even saw it between different versions of Windows, when 95, when you used to get things that said, you know, Win32XE not running, trying to get information to users that ultimately enables them to make informed decisions. And I think that's one of the big challenges in understanding the psychology of how these accidental insider threats occur.
And I just want to assure Tom, I wasn't suggesting you don't need antivirus software. I was just saying that the human behavior is a factor. We have to understand how people will change their behavior based on the introduction of a new control. Could I answer one thing about policies, though?
Sure.
I would say that the CERT Insider Threat Center, having done a lot of research, has created 16 best practices, which will actually be effective for both intentional and unintentional insider threats. We actually have three new ones, which we're about to publish as soon as we get through the review process. And so that'll be a total of 19 best practices that are policies that you can implement throughout your organization. And what you'll see is that it doesn't just apply to the IT department. I mean, there are HR policy recommendations in there. There are legal policy recommendations all across the spectrum, along with some technical controls and stuff like that. So I agree that it does have to be a much broader response than just the IT department.
So I'm a firm believer that organizations really need to push back on executives, because BYOD is really bring your own malware. And when you think about how there's been an explosion of custom attack code for mobile platforms that's being developed in the underground arms bazaars that I spoke of, how there's over 35,000 instances of mobile malware for Android platforms that were released in the first 6 months of this year. The fact that iOS is being extremely targeted by the hacker community, that's the Apple devices that you all love and trust, because of its dependency on Safari for the user experience, and so you're seeing hackers manipulate and attack Safari of itself. We need to also respect the fact that we're seeing attacks or proximity attacks that used to be leveraged by people in the intelligence community are being leveraged through your device. If I hack your device right now, I can then launch Bluetooth attacks against everyone sitting next to you because their Bluetooth is probably on. And I can also pop the microphone in that sensitive meeting. I can turn on the camera in that sensitive meeting. I can get transcripts of what's said. And this is happening globally in the financial sector in sensitive boardroom meetings now. So you got to get to a point where you either make the device context aware, where it limits functionality specific to the experience, like I'm banking online, so this thing shouldn't be accessing Facebook, it shouldn't be Bluetoothing, it shouldn't be texting messages and exfiltrating my passwords. Or we need to get to a point where we become more rigorous in our implementation of MDM capabilities, but with a recognition that mobile device managers, you can still get underneath them. And so don't just implicitly trust a device because it's got an MDM on it.
And I'll maybe just add into that point, because I completely agree that the mobile platform is an inflection point in the overall threat landscape. And one of the things that we've noticed is that in many cases, the mobile platforms are not secured with the same fundamental secure development practices that are occurring much more in the base operating system space and in the application space on top of that. So when you have, and this is one of the things we love, is this robust developer ecosystem. That's great. That's bringing us all the apps that we want. But we also have to start thinking about how do we then build up the base and enable them to do more secure development through tooling. This is something Microsoft has learned over the course of the last 10 years with our secure development lifecycle, really reducing the number of vulnerabilities and reducing the severity. And that kind of thinking needs to move over into the mobile space.
How does this become even more complex for the multinational organization? So we've talked, I think we've had sort of a U.S. focus to date, and given where we are and some of the things that we do around the Beltway, I think that's great. But we have a lot of firms who have multinational employees, multinational points of presence, and obviously as you deal with distributed employees, you increase the chance for accidental threats. When you look at both what may be complex about being a multinational organization versus a domestic organization in terms of implementation of policy, and also maybe effective use of legislation that is or is yet to be coming, what are some comments that you could provide in terms of thoughts for managers who are dealing with multinational situations?
Well, I can tackle that one. We know that many of our organizations now are multinational. And so one of the challenges that I hear often is, well, that works great in the United States, but in country X, I'm not allowed to monitor employee behavior, or in country Y, I'm not allowed to, you know, collect phone log data, something like that. So yeah, there are definitely some challenges, but if you actually look at what the framework is that you have in that country, there are almost always some type of mitigating strategies that you can take. So, you know, it would be great if you had 20 pieces of data and you could add them all together and say, oh, I've detected an unintentional insider threat. But if you don't have those 20 pieces of data, well, let's figure out what other kinds of data that we can provide that you can look at, that you can analyze. It may not be the complete solution when you look at it, but it's enough to say we have to look deeper. So a quick example of that might be, if you're not allowed to monitor employee behavior in a specific country, well, what if the data was always sitting inside the United States so that the user was actually remoting into the United States through thin client or something like that? Would that, in fact, be a method because you're not monitoring the data in another country, you're monitoring the data inside the United States? It's a very simplistic example, but it's the kind of thing that I think is possible to do if people are willing to take the time to examine it.
Well, this really brings in the question of cloud. Every MNC is going to be using cloud infrastructure providers to facilitate their global operations. You have to be very acutely aware of the security environment and the security provisions being provided by that infrastructure provider and choose the right one. This will be the biggest decision you make as an MNC in today's world. You have to embrace those infrastructure providers who are truly embracing defense in depth and cybersecurity in the cloud. Fun fact, virtualized environments, cloud environments, you know that most of your firewalls and intrusion detection systems have no idea of what goes on in those environments. They're completely blind to them. In addition to the fact that, again, if someone can colonize your cloud, it's like a mailman that can open an entire wall of mailboxes or a neighbor that gets cockroaches. You have a significant problem with the asymmetrical and magnitude of that threat. So cloud security and embracing cloud infrastructures that are more secure is an imperative. And the last point is this. If you're operating multinational, and I find it an interesting question because foreign companies consider themselves a country of that nation state, because most nation states have industrial policies. You've all heard Melissa Hathaway talk about this. Only the US and two others doesn't have an industrial policy. So you as a US multinational operating overseas are not just being targeted by your insiders and organized crime, you're being targeted by nation states to steal your data because they have an industrial policy to improve their comparative advantage in the global marketplace. So you've got a greater attack surface, and that's my point.
Actually, I'll build on that exact point, which is the attack surface and understanding the attack surface and managing it is one of the most key things that any company can do, multinational or not. And the thing that I like to think about in this space is threat modeling. So understanding what your real crown jewels are, understanding where they exist, having a good understanding of the attack surface, and then thinking in threat modeling, not just about the malicious, but what are the different paths that can occur to the crown jewels. And so regardless of whether you're a multinational or not, this idea of understanding your attack surface and modeling the threat point of view into it is something that each organization should roll into their overall risk management strategy.
Which brings us to legislation. Just to touch on a hot topic right now around cybersecurity legislation, legislation that could be helpful to domestic or multinational companies in this area. Angela, you have some thoughts around legislation or policies?
Well, specific to the insider threat, I would say most of the legislation that's going on right now is not, at least in the U.S., is not in that space. But I do think that one of the things that we've noticed, not just with U.S. policy, but policies that are emerging in other countries, is the blending and melding, the multidisciplinary aspect that is now occurring in what we would traditionally call cybersecurity policy. So you have issues like breach disclosure rolled in or fraud rolled in. And sometimes you think about that as what is the appropriate balance of security and privacy. I think one of the things that I hear that's concerning quite often is people feel like there's a distinct trade-off, that if I'm going to have this security, I'm going to lose privacy. And I don't like to think about it as a zero-sum game. There may be equities that you have to balance, and that's something that policymakers need to be thinking about and working with the vendor space and the civil liberties community to make sure that they manage that appropriately.
So I've also seen that there are unintended consequences with legislation. And so that's, I think, a big factor that has to be considered. If you talk to a lot of organizations, you will find that they have to have so many boxes that they have to check for different kinds of requirements, FISMA, Sarbanes-Oxley, I mean, on and on and on, so that when you say to them, okay, well, let's do this thing for unintentional insider threat, they say, look, I have this much funding, and these are all the things I have to do based on legislated requirements. And so sometimes we're missing the forest for the trees. I mean, some of the things that we're trying to protect that now, today, are probably easily replaceable and very low cost. For instance, probably everyone in the audience has had at least an experience of one credit card that they had to replace because it was compromised. I mean, how much did it cost you? Probably nothing today. And how long did it take? Maybe 24 hours. But we spend lots and lots of time trying to protect against that type of incident. And we spend lots of money doing that as well. And I'll yield the remainder of my time back to the moderator.
Okay. Do you find then, I mean, as a result of the unintentional consequence of legislation and some firms taking a head in the sand approach versus a proactive approach to identifying risk and dealing with risk, or do you find there's just an inevitable balance that's going to happen because of it?
So I know I'm at a booze event, but there was a great study produced by SAIC and McAfee that surveyed 1,000 publicly traded companies.
You're not invited anymore.
This study noted that 53% of those 1,000 publicly traded companies acknowledged that they had been breached, didn't report it, and didn't remediate it. So they're still polluted now. They're still colonized right now. Those infrastructures are still attacking their user bases right now. But what does that say? You know, trend has come out in support of the legislation that's been on the Hill for the simple fact that I walked into this room today, and there's a fire sensor on the wall, and there's locks on the doors, and there's a building code. At a minimum, there has to be a standard of care, due diligence that's set up. There's enough regulatory environment that exists to currently regulate the environment, but it needs to be modernized. The fact that we're still doing SAS 70 audits of third parties that connect to us and how that somehow corresponds to a cloud environment and an environment where attacks can happen in nanoseconds still boggles my mind. But it's all about modernization of existing regulation and empowering folks like law enforcement to increase penalties and to increase the already existing institutions that exist today to preserve safety and soundness here.
Any other comments from you all on that topic?
I guess the one thing I would just add in is that I think there's a great disparity across infrastructures, critical and non-critical, in terms of their acclimation to the cybersecurity risks that are there. You oftentimes do see organizations that are quite advanced, and in those cases, the attacks that they, the insiders that they're getting are probably not accidental. They're more the advanced, or if we would call it determined or persistent adversary. But I think trying to group and say that there's one bucket and that people are either not paying attention or paying attention is very challenging. It's different by industry, it's different within industry, and it's different. Sometimes organizations may understand the risk, but they don't yet have the capabilities to respond to it. And so when thinking about whether it's regulation, legislation, and how you start to use the levers of government in order to mitigate that risk, I do think you have to start to look at the disparity that exists across infrastructures.
Thanks. With the time we have left, we're moving toward the end of today's discussion. I just wanted to quickly go around round robin and ask for a follow-up thought from each of you, perhaps in the area of overall, what's the most significant challenge surrounding insider threats, specifically the accidental insider? And do you feel like organizations, to Angela's point, you can't make it a generic comment, but do you feel like most organizations are prepared to deal with those threats? And I'll start with you, Michael.
All right, thank you. I have found through my experience that it really only takes three things to protect from any kind of a threat, whether it's an intentional or unintentional insider threat, it's a cyber threat, it's a physical threat in the real world. And that is, the first thing is you have to make an accurate judgment of trust. Okay, so do I trust the person who's using this computer? Do I trust that mobile device that is attaching to my network? Do I trust this attachment in the email to click on it? You know, whatever it is, do I have an accurate judgment of trust? In cyberspace, that can be very difficult to do because we judge people based on our observation of them in the world of bricks and mortar and try to determine whether we can trust them in our cyberspace. The second thing that you have to do is accurately right-size permissions. Okay, so you have to right-size permissions. People have to be able to accomplish what they need to do, but do they really need to be able to do a lot more? I mean, does a system administrator need to be able to look through the customer database or through the financial, you know, reporting, you know, those kinds of things? And then the third thing is you have to effectively monitor, because you don't get what you expect, you get what you inspect. And that's a very famous Admiral Rickover quote. But it's true. I mean, with your children, you don't just say, hey, brush your teeth, and then 18 years later you wait to see if that worked out, right? You check every day, you inspect, you know. So you have to be able to do that. If you can do those three things, you can protect against any type of threat. But it's difficult to accurately judge trust. It's hard to right-size permissions. And sometimes it's difficult to monitor, depending on if you're multinational or something like that. But trust, permit, monitor, or TPM is the way that I try to think about it. Anytime I'm trying to create a policy, bring in a new tool or a new procedure, I'm thinking, how does it fit into trust, permit, or monitor?
I think our comments will be very complementary to each other. First of all, I'll say three things. Number one, which is integrate a overall comprehensive risk management strategy into your organization, but also roll the insights back into your overall risk management strategy. Second of all is a simple thing. Manage IT systems. Keep up basic hygiene so that when an accidental insider occurs, it is less likely to occur, and that adversaries that are trying to take advantage of unknowing, unwilling insiders, it's harder. They have to go to more of the advanced techniques in order to do that. And last really is just establishing this effective response capability so that when incidents occur, you know how to respond and you know how to mitigate the overall consequences of any event that does occur. And I would just say, I think it is really challenging to understand organizations' preparedness in this space. I think it is an area of emerging analysis.
I would agree with all of those comments. I would stress that in order to achieve what I call advanced persistent response in 2012, we have to deal with it on an internal policy level. And first and foremost to that, we need to combine our mobile security strategy with our cloud security strategy. Don't make them separate silos. The mobile is just the endpoint for that cloud infrastructure, so make sure you're thinking that through. Second, I think penetration testing and attack path mapping, not just from the perspective of hacking your systems from the outside in, but understanding if this was a malicious insider or this device went rogue, where could they get from here, is fundamental for your own internal situational awareness. So the second recommendation is, how do you improve that situational awareness through that attack path mapping, through that greater understanding? And then lastly, it's really about cyber intelligence. Are you aware of what's going on in the outside world as it relates to you, or what's going on internal to your system as it relates to the outside world? How are you actually ascertaining what type of lateral movement that might be an anomaly within yourself is constructing a panacea for some digital insider?
Well, thank you. I'd like to thank our distinguished panelists for their contributions to this discussion today. Today's Expert Voices panel, The Accidental Insider Threat, Is Your Organization Ready?, featured Tom Kellerman, Vice President of Cybersecurity at Trend Micro, Angela McKay, Principal Security Strategist on the Global Security Strategy and Diplomacy Team at Microsoft, and Michael Theis, Chief Counterintelligence Expert, CERT Insider Threat Center. Thank you all.
Federal News Radio in a Web 2.0 world. Find Federal News Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio or join the Federal News Radio group on Facebook. Chat with our team and make connections with others in the federal arena. Email us at fnrcomment@federalnewsradio.com. Visit our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, your source for federal news now.
Longevity's Breathe Deep DC is an annual 5K walk to fight lung cancer, the nation's number one cancer killer. Longevity Foundation is funding life-saving lung cancer research and providing information and support to those affected. Gather family and friends and join Breathe Deep DC Sunday, November 4th at 9 a.m. at the Washington Monument. There is hope for earlier detection and better treatments for lung cancer. To participate, visit longevity.org/DC.
Hello, this is Peter Bergman. Please join WTOP, Bergman's Cleaning, and the Salvation Army for the 21st annual Share the Warmth Coats for Kids and the Needy Drive. If you have one or more cold weather coats, please donate them for this worthy cause by calling Bergman's Cleaning. Bergman's will clean and then deliver them to the Salvation Army for distribution to the needy in the metro area. Over 500,000 coats have been collected since 1991. Make this year's drive a success by calling Bergman's at 703-247-7600. Thank you.
So, guess what I just heard?
You mean about the Roth TSP?
Okay, yeah. Well, also...
that bid protest on the DoD contract.
Right, but did you know...
who the Senate confirmed for the administrator's job?
Well, what about...
OMB's digital strategy.
Jeez, how do you know everything that's going on in the federal government?
I know, because I signed up for Federal News Radio's email alerts.
Be in the know and know it first with Federal News Radio's email alerts. Sign up today at federalnewsradio.com. Search email alerts.